right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Monday, February 16th, 2015. And this says, before the first cup of jewels here on UCY.TV, happy freezing Monday. I believe the storm name is Octavia that's heading toward the East Coast. It is currently -5 degrees here in upstate New York, and I am freezing my ass off. You don't even know how cold it is out here right now, and I'm sure that this little heater behind me is not going to do very much good. Everybody down in the southeast, stay safe. I saw that they are predicting a foot to a foot and a half of snow in Kentucky, which is pretty unusual. So that should be fun. I'm done. I'm done with winter. All right. So this morning, we are going to continue where we left off on Friday. We listened to a lecture. Oh, and I don't remember her name again. Somebody in chat will have to remind me. I'm sorry, it's Monday morning and I am just drinking my first cup of coffee. We listened to a lecture that talked about some synthetic biology that was pretty interesting. And then we listened to Dr. Huber and compared some of the stuff that he was finding in GMO foods that were very similar to some of the stuff that Clifford Carnarvon was pulling out of the air in New Mexico. We continued on looking at nanotech and nanotech in our food. And I think that's where we're going to kick it off today, is looking at nanotech in our food. Let's see for a minute here. Actually, here, what we're going to do, let me connect up. All right. I want to listen to the very end. Oh, that sounded horrible. I want to listen to the very end. After we turned that lecture off, there were a few more interesting things that came out of it that I want you to hear, and then we'll kick it off from there. So hold on. My computers are so cold, they don't want to work.
The field of synthetic biology is a new frontier of science. It draws from biochemistry and biomedicine, genetics, robotics, radiation biology, and information technologies. Using nanotechnology, its goals are to improve and transcend the limits of nature. On February 21st of this year, Time magazine had a feature story on the singularity, the term signifying the merging of man with machine. The story was released on Valentine's Day, February 14th, to underscore a love affair, the marriage of humanity and technology. The article tells us that a transformation is coming, and our species, Homo sapien, will no longer be recognizable as itself. We will.
I want to stop for 1 second. So, yes, Sophia Smallstrom, thank you very much, Dell. I don't know why I couldn't remember her name, and I definitely want to try and get in contact with her. So, she talks about the 2045 project and the Time magazine article. We talked about 2045 a couple days ago, but she said that part of 2045, what they say is that the human genome will no longer be recognizable. And that reminded me of this clip that came out of RT News back in September. Check this out. Maybe. Hold on. Oh, come
Come
on.
on.
It's trying.
And Homo sapien 2.0, according to a researcher at the Global Brain Institute, a completely new human species will inhabit the Earth in just over 30 years. Now, this evolutionary step could be comparable to the transition from apes to humans. So, what kind of people will we become?
Good question as it's sitting here spooling. I think it's too cold for the internet to flow. It's getting all frozen in the lines. All right, here's the rest.
Well, they say our biological clocks will undergo dramatic changes, which will allow us to live longer and give birth at an older age. And of course, technology will continue to make our lives easier. All kinds of microchip implants will be placed in our ears and our fingers and make many devices completely obsolete. But this dependence on technology has its drawbacks, of course. In the future, humans are going to have to compete for jobs against, you guessed it, machines and cyborgs. And since most of the work will already be done and automated by robots, a sedentary way of life will ultimately take over and make us all a little bit bigger.
And make us all pretty useless. It's just nuts. So Sophia Smallstrom was talking about how, you know, 2045 project, and we already know that, said that they were going to change us. And then we start seeing all this news about self-replicating nanobots able to cure cancer now. And in 30 years from now, we are not going to be the same human species. I mean, the writing is on the wall. And if you can't see it, I don't know how much simpler to make it for you. All right, let's listen to a little bit more of Sophia's lecture because she gets into the singularity now.
It'll be something new, something better. The time predicted for this transformation is 2045. The man who is making this prediction is Ray Kurzweil, a futurist known for his uncanny accuracy in just this area, the pace at which technology grows and improves, such that it will one day be smarter and better than us. That's the singularity. There's a Singularity University hosted by NASA, sponsored by Google, to teach people about the intelligence explosion. Ray Kurzweil has made fortunes over and over as an engineer and inventor. A documentary about him is called The Transcendent Man. He wrote the best-selling book that you see here, The Singularity Is Near, which came out in 2005. Singularity is a word from astrophysics referring to a point in space-time where the rules of ordinary physics no longer apply.
You know, the thing is that Kurzweil, before he became director of engineering at Google, was kind of on the fringe. And back in 2005, and way before, I mean, he's been around for a long time in the industry of technology, people always looked at him as kind of like the crazy mad scientist who wants to upload himself to the machine. I mean, no one ever really took him seriously. But once he was appointed director of engineering at Google, they launched the Brain Project and they gave him an unlimited budget. That's when all of this insane stuff really kicked off into high gear, and they are making it a reality.
Kurzweil has correctly predicted the growth of information technologies. He has made it clear to the world that technological progress is exponential, not linear, which means that advancement begins to advance itself in a manner of speaking. Exponential curves start slowly and then explode. A quote from the Time magazine article: in Kurzweil's future, biotechnology and nanotechnology give us the power to manipulate our bodies and the world around us at will, at the molecular level. We ditch Darwin and take charge of our own evolution.
Yeah, how scary is that? I mean, that's what we've been talking about. That's what nanotech does. It allows them, with synthetic biology, to take control of nature and our bodies at an atomic level and manipulate it.
The question is, who is we and what is at will? Whose will? Kurzweil predicts that by 2020, we will have successfully reverse engineered the human brain. And when hyper-intelligent artificial intelligence arrives, all we have to do is hand ourselves off to it. Armed with advanced nanotechnology, AI will solve the problems of the world. Strong AI, they use this term, is a super powerful, broad spectrum intelligence that operates as easily and comfortably as a human being. It isn't just a chess playing computer. It's a machine intelligence that can pass for human in a blind test, which is as close as you can get to consciousness or sentience. Now, once this kind of intelligence is here, what will it do as a newly created inhabitant of the Earth? Would it compete with us for resources? More intelligent than we are, would it treat us as lesser beings? Would it recognize that we made it, or would it overrun us? Kurzweil is one of the world's leading transhumanists, number 30 on Time's most influential list. Transhumanists believe that we ourselves should merge with machines, Imagine a time when we can download our brains into a computer and upload a computer into our brains.
She's clicking. She's having trouble.
The three great overlapping revolutions sometimes goes by the letter G and R. And G stands for genetics. Really, another word for it is biotechnology, is mastering the information processes in our biology. And we ultimately will actually be able to reprogram biology away from disease and from aging. N stands for nanotechnology. In the next 25 years, we will have blood cell-sized devices that go inside your body and keep you healthy from inside.
Blood cell-type devices, at the beginning, or more toward the beginning, in this lecture from Sophia Smallstrom, she had talked about the red blood cells that Clifford Carnicorn had found in the air in New Mexico. And they lived outside of the body in a petri dish. And he's saying that, oh, yeah, we'll have these red blood cell type devices that will be able to, you know, keep us healthy. This is already happening. And remember, I believe that this lecture or this talk that she's playing from Kurzweil was back in the mid-2000s.
Go in your brain and interact with your biological neurons and allow us to merge with non-biological intelligence. The third one goes by the letter R, which stands for robotics, robots. Really, though, refers to artificial intelligence. And that's the most significant revolution of all. In about 20 years, I've set the date 2029, a machine, an AI, will be able to match human intelligence and go beyond it. Artificial intelligence, which will give us not just more human intelligence, but will actually give us superhuman intelligence, will enable us to solve problems that we're not able to solve today.
Artificial blood cells are mentioned again in The Transcendent Man.
All right. Is that it? I don't know. She's stopping here, but it might be my video that's stopping.
Biology is very impressive and intricate, clever, but also very suboptimal compared to what we ultimately will be able to engineer with nanotechnology. We are building devices now that are at the nanoscale. This is a design for a robotic red blood cell. Conservative analysis of these RESPR sites shows that if you would replace a portion of your red blood cells with these robotic versions, you could do an Olympic sprint for 15 minutes without taking a breath, or sit at the bottom of your pool for 4 hours. We'll be able to download software against specific pathogens, including ones that have never been seen before, not be subject to autoimmune disorders. And if you look at what will be in principle feasible with nanotechnology, we can go far beyond the limitations of our version one bodies.
You notice he calls them version one bodies too. He also mentioned being able to swim underwater for 4 hours without having to come up for oxygen. They just announced that they have that ability back about 2 months ago. And that was, he was saying, using these red blood cells, the robotic red blood cells. And remember, red blood cells are what transport oxygen through your bloodstream.
The robotic blood cells will supposedly improve us and keep us healthy, as he says. But what if that's just the gloss to sell us on such bodily intrusions? Just as we're being sold on the idea of a smart environment, a techno matrix that will vibrate with not just intelligence but connection. What indeed is the World Wide Web? We may think it's the internet, but it will be the humming network of everything connected through ubiquitous intelligence, intelligence that is everywhere. Artificial intelligence will connect the world. Homo sapien will be transformed into Homo evolutus. Biological processes will be run by technology. Living things will not be reproductive. The Earth will be populated with engineered species, and all processes will be patented, licensed, and controlled.
She's absolutely correct. That's exactly what they're doing.
You could consider nanotechnology the installation of artificial intelligence in living and non-living things. Smart dust and smart modes, for instance, are tiny nanosensors that can float and land anywhere. As Kurzweil declares, self-replicating nanotechnology will infuse everything around us with itself.
I see as a person, I'm human, and I'm really limited and restricted in what I do. So if I could come out of the singularity, being mentally and physically upgraded, yeah, I'd go for that. I don't mind changing dramatically from what I am.
I believe fully there will be flash memories you can plug into your brain. We'll be able to hook our brains into calculators and statistics programs and have Google directly into the frontal lobes. I mean, there's going to be a lot of expansion of the mind through interfacing the human brain with technology. There's an unanswered question of how far can you go and still be human.
As we merge with the machine, and I think it's inevitable that we will transform into something new.
And as the technology becomes vastly superior to what we are, then the small proportion that's still human gets smaller and smaller and smaller until it's just utterly negligible.
Anybody who is going to be resisting this progress forward is going to be resisting evolution. And fundamentally, they will die out.
And I think that's the point. If you don't merge with the machine, then you are going to die out. I mean, these people are ready to give up their humanity. And the thing that's so worrisome about this is that, you know, they're talking about this is all in the future, but they're putting it into our food and into our environment and into our air, and it's ending up in our water. And we are consuming it and being assimilated as we speak. All right, let me kill this connection. There's more, but... hold on. There we go. I can't stand that hiss. There's more, but I have so much more stuff to talk about that maybe we can go back to the rest of that tomorrow. All right. So interestingly enough, a story then comes out of RT yesterday afternoon titled 12 Likely Causes of the Apocalypse as Seen by Scientists. And of course, anything with a title like that always gets my attention. They list them out from the least probable to the most probable. So the least probable, asteroid impact. Next least probable, super volcanic eruption. Next least probable, global pandemic. That's a probability of 0.0001%. Nuclear war is 0.01%. Extreme climate change, also 0.01%. Oh, what's more likely? Synthetic biology. The most damaging impact from synthetic biology to human civilization would come from an engineered pathogen targeting humans or a crucial component of the ecosystem, the report states. Such would emerge from military or commercial biowarfare, bioterrorism, or leaked pathogens. Yes, they neglect to mention that there is no one watching the hen house and the pathogens have already leaked. What's the next most probable? Oh, nanotechnology. Atomically precise manufacturing would create smarter, extremely resilient materials and allow many different groups to manufacture a wide range of things, including large arsenals of novel weapons such as nuclear ones. Yes, and atomic level ones that get into your body. That's also a 0.01%. Unknown consequences? Well, that could be anything. Ecological collapse? Yeah, that's on its way. Wait till you hear the new NASA report. Global system collapse? Yeah, well, that's kind of happening too. World economic and political systems that are interconnected and prone to system-wide failures cause caused by the structure of the network, economic collapse is usually accompanied by social chaos, civil unrest, and the breakdown of law and order. Future bad governance, that is number two. And lastly, the most probable of all of the mentioned causes of apocalypses, artificial intelligence. Yep, it is. The creation of human-level intelligence that can result in the possibility that this intelligence will be driven to construct a world without humans. There is also a possibility of artificial intelligence waging war or creating, quote, whole brain emulations that would give machines human minds. On the other hand, the report also says that it is probable that such an intelligence could counter other apocalyptic causes presented in this study. I got to tell you, that made me feel all warm and fuzzy. Another story that I ran across yesterday is researchers have now found a DNA clock that predicts how long you'll live. And they can measure how quickly it is running down as well. You know, cracking the DNA genomics code, Obama said that that was the biggest accomplishment of the 20th century. And like I've said previous, I used to think it was pretty cool, but it's not cool anymore. It's not cool when they can make spider goats and when they can target individual proteins on your DNA strands and make them into something else. Now, I actually put together some stuff today on a different page so I could go back and find stuff that I posted in January that we never got to. So now we're really going to dig into some of this nanotech and food. All right, let's take a look at this, because we found out in a clip that we heard on Friday, that was the Australian clip we kicked the show off with, that many of these corporations are using nanotech and it doesn't need to be labeled. And we knew that. It doesn't need to be labeled, just like GMO doesn't need to be labeled. All right, this is from a website called Nanowerk, W-E-R-K.com. Nanotechnology has begun to find potential applications in the area of functional food by engineering biological molecules toward functions very different from those that they have in nature, opening up a whole new area of research and development. Of course, there seems to be no limit to what food technologists are prepared to do to our food, and nanotechnology will give them a whole new set of tools to go to new extremes. But there are some positives. Yeah, not in my book, there isn't. Let's take a look at some beneficial effects of nanotechnology. To me, these are detrimental effects. They're messing around with it in agriculture. Now, when we talk about agriculture, all I think about is some of what we heard Dr. Huber talk about and how similar the unidentified organisms that he's been finding, the ones that we discovered, deplete manganese in the food chain, not only in plants and animals, but also in people. And we'll have to look at that, because I dug up some info on manganese depletion that was kind of interesting. It says, here is an overview of what nanotechnology applications are currently being researched, tested, and in some cases are already applied in food technology, agriculture, singular molecule detection to determine enzyme and substrate interactions, nanocapsules for delivery of pesticides, fertilizers, and other agrochemicals, delivery of growth hormones in controlled fashions, nanosensors for monitoring soil conditions and crop growth, nanochips for identity preservation and tracking, nanosensors for detection of animal and plant pathogens, nanocapsules to deliver vaccines. Yes, that's the virus-like particle in the Gardasil vaccine. That's exactly what it is. And nanoparticles to deliver DNA to plants targeted genetic engineering. In food processing, nanocapsules to improve the bioavailability of nutraceuticals in standard ingredients such as cooking oils, and we discovered that it's already in some cooking oils. Nano-encapsulated flavor enhancers, and we're going to take a look at some of that. That was mentioned also in that Australian clip we heard on Friday, that they have this nano goo that they can make to be any flavor they want. Nanotubes and nanoparticles as gelatin, and viscifying agents. Nanocapsule infusion of plant-based steroids to replace a meat's cholesterol. Wow, that sounds lovely. Nanoparticles to selectively bind and remove chemicals or pathogens from food. Yeah, that was something that I already saw they were attempting back in, I believe the video was from 2008, in chickens. They were putting nanoparticles in chicken feed to be able to pull out the salmonella within the chicken and other pathogens as it passed through the chicken's intestines. And I actually have a video for that. If I can find it quick after I read the story, we'll play it. But that was from 2008. And what made me think of Dr. Huber when I was watching that chicken video is that was almost the identical thing that he was saying was going on in the animals and in the soil, is that these, whatever they were that they were putting into the crops, were killing the flora in the soil and in the intestines of the animals that were eating the plants that were growing in these GMO fields. Also, nanoemulsions and particles for better availability and dispersions of nutrients. And Dr. Huber talked about that too, how they can encapsulate nutritional value. Well, not nutritional value, but let's say minerals and vitamins and nutrients. They can encapsulate them within nanoparticles. And there's two things that I've discovered that they can do with them. One is they're saying that they can target parts of the body that need certain nutrients with these nano-encapsulated nutrients. But one of the other things I discovered is a lot of your low-fat diet foods are also using nanotechnology. And what they're doing is they're encapsulating, let's say, the fat, or they're encapsulating things that they deem not good for you to prevent the absorption of those nutrients when you ingest them. So when we were hearing about the manganese deficiency and how animals now that are eating this GMO feed, they're discovering that the feed that used to provide the majority of the nutrition for the animal is now only providing a portion of the nutrition for the animal. And I'm going to tell you, that's probably exactly what they're doing. I mean, you start to see that all of these groups, I mean, I didn't realize in the beginning that GMO was connected in any way, shape, or form to nanotech until we had read that yearly report for 2014 talking about Monsanto messing around with that RNAi technology. The I in RNAi stands for interference, which means that, like what we were talking about, where they can encapsulate nutrients and prevent your body from absorbing it, that's an interference. When they can go into a gene and they can turn off a certain functionality in your DNA, that's an interference. They also have food packaging nanotechnology, antibodies attached to fluorescent nanoparticles. And that fluorescence, remember, we learned was called luciferase. Nanoparticles to detect chemicals or foodborne pathogens. Biodegradable nanosensors for temperature, moisture, and time monitoring. Nano clays and nanofilms as a barrier material to prevent spoilage and prevent oxygen absorption. Electrochemical nanosensors to detect ethylene. Antimicrobial and antifungal surface coatings with nanoparticles using silver, magnesium, zinc, etc. Lighter, stronger, and more heat-resistant films with silicate nanoparticles and modified permeation behavior of the foils. There actually was a new story from a few weeks ago about this new foil that they've come out with to use in packaging. Typically, they said it's used in things like potato chips. Also, the fourth place that they are proposing using mass nanoparticulates are in supplements, i.e. vitamins. Nano-sized powders to increase the absorption of nutrients. Yes, or we found out decrease. Cellulose nanocrystal composites as a drug carrier. Nano-encapsulation of nutraceuticals for better absorption, better stability, and targeted delivery. Nano-chelates. This is what Dr. Huber was talking about. Coiled nanoparticles to deliver nutrients more efficiently to cells without affecting color or taste of food. And he was talking about nanochelates actually preventing the absorption of those nutrients. And then vitamin sprays dispersing active molecules into nano droplets for better absorption. That's really horrifying. Research has begun to address the potential applications of nanotechnology for functional foods and nutraceuticals by applying the new concepts and engineering approaches involved in nanomaterials to target the delivery of bioactive compounds and micronutrients. Nanomaterials allow better encapsulation and release efficiency of the active food ingredients compared to traditional encapsulating agents in the development of nanoemulsions, liposomes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, it makes you wonder if they can encapsulate things and then target drug delivery within your body. So you swallow it, you can't taste it. It's for better, you know, they can load it up with all kinds of great things and you're never going to taste it. And then we can target. I mean, this is kind of the same sort of technology that they want to use for these self-replicating nanobots and cancer therapy to be able to put the chemotherapy, encapsulate it into the nanoparticle and then target the cancer cells to deliver the poison directly to that cell. Who's to say that they couldn't put something more nefarious into any of these nano-encapsulated particles? A little bit of arsenic here and there. Get you a little bit sicker every time you take your vitamin or every time you eat your, you know, whatever. So then you got to go to the doctor and now you have this syndrome that requires all kinds of research and new drugs to make you better. And to me, none of this, none of this is what we should be standing for at all. And on the heels of all this, doesn't a story come out yesterday from IO9? The FDA is hiding scientific fraud and you should be pissed. Now remember, the FDA is not watching the hen house at all on any of this stuff. And we knew that they were letting all kinds of stuff go through. Probably a butt slap and some slippery palms involved. Let's read this. When the FDA encounters instances of scientific misconduct, it buries the evidence. A recent investigation sheds light on the extent of the problem. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the agency that's tasked with protecting the public health via regulation of everything from food safety to prescription drugs. Oh, how convenient. Everywhere we have nanotechnology. Occasionally encounters some serious instances of misconduct in biomedical research. According to an investigation published in the latest issue of the Journal of American Medical Association, these cases include, quote, falsification or submission of false information, problems with adverse events reporting, oh, wait, that's the vaccine database, protocol violations, oh, what is that, testing shit on people that wasn't approved? I'm just postulating here. Another one, inadequate or inaccurate record keeping. Oh, and failure to protect the safety of patients and or issues with oversight or informed consent, among other violations. This is everything we've been talking about. And now we have the proof that, yes, it wasn't just a creeping suspicion that the FDA wasn't making sure that we were safe. They're not. They're just letting this shit flow. Study author Charles Schief, an acclaimed science writer and professor of journalism at NYU, there's NYU again, writes that, quote, the FDA has no systematic method of communicating these findings to the scientific community, leaving open the possibility that research misconduct detected by a government agency goes unremarked in the peer-reviewed literature. In the course of his investigation, he identified 57 published clinical trials for which an FDA inspection of the trial site had turned up, quote unquote, significant evidence for at least one of the aforementioned problems. The problem with these problems is that they are not reported, at least not in any meaningful way. The FDA has no systematic method of communicating these findings to the scientific community, writes Seif, leaving open the possibility that research misconduct detected by a government agency goes unremarked in the peer-reviewed literature. By failing to make this information readily available, the FDA compromises the ability of scientists, doctors, and the public, and that means you, to remain informed about scientific trials fraught with misconduct. Surprise! The most troubling thing about the FDA's reticence about these matters is that it is characterized by more than silence. As Seif writes in a supplemental piece published at Slate, the FDA is engaged in, quote, active deception, unquote. Man, this guy, Seif, better keep himself safe. He might just have a car accident at 300 miles an hour in the middle of New York City. So he says the FDA is engaged in, quote unquote, active deception. This is something that the FDA has been accused of in the past. In his piece, Seif writes that the process by which he and his students dug up even more damning evidence of the FDA's surreptitious practices. Quote, my students and I looked at FDA documents relating to roughly 600 clinical trials in which one of the researchers running the trial failed an FDA inspection. In only roughly 100 of the cases were we able to figure out which study, which drug, and which pharmaceutical company were involved. Remember, they're all in freaking bed together. And this precision medicine bullshit in the Brain Project is bringing everybody under the same guise. The federal government is perpetrating even larger crimes against humanity than we accused them of before. This is genocide. Continuing on, we cracked a bunch of the redactions by cross-referencing the documents with some clinical trial data, checking various other databases, and using carefully crafted Google searches. For the other 500 of the trials, the FDA was successfully able to shield the drug maker and the study sponsor from public exposure. It is not just the public that's in the dark. It's the researchers, too, and your doctor. As I described in the current issue of JAMA Internal Medicine, my students and I were able to track down some 78 scientific publications resulting from tainted studies. A clinical trial in which the FDA inspectors found significant problems with the conduct of the trial, up to and including fraud, and in only 3 cases did we find any hint in peer review literature of problems found by the FDA inspectors. The other publications were not retracted, corrected, or highlighted in any way. So all these fucking reports and research that they're coming into our face in a mainstream TV about vaccines are safe. Look at all the studies. Vaccines are safe. I'm going to scream bull fucking shit. This right here is proof that we cannot trust anything in any scientific freaking study that they are coming out with. It's all about payola and slippery palms. You know, and so they're not even retracting it. And it says that they're not updating the adverse reaction database, which we knew that. There's only a very, very small number that are reported. In other words, the FDA knows about dozens of scientific papers floating around whose data are questionable and has said nothing, leaving physicians and medical researchers completely unaware. The silence is unbroken, even when the FDA itself seems shocked at the degree of fraud and misconduct in a clinical trial. Such was the case with the so-called Record 4 study. Record 4 was one of four large clinical trials that involved thousands of patients who were recruited at scores of clinical sites in more than a dozen countries around the world. The trial was used as evidence that the new anti-blood clotting agent, I don't know, I can try to say this, rivaroxaban, was safe and effective. The FDA inspected or had access to external audits of 16 of the Record 4 sites. A trial was a fiasco. At Dr. Craig Luke's site in Colorado, the FDA found falsified data. And at Dr. Ricardo Esquivel's site in Mexico, there was, quote, systematic discarding of medical records that made it impossible to tell whether or not the study drug was even given to the patients. At half of the sites that drew FDA scrutiny, 8 out of 16, there was misconduct, fraud, fishy behavior, and other practices that were so objectionable that the data had to be thrown out. The problems were so bad and so widespread that, contrary to its usual practice, the FDA declared the entire study to be unreliable. Yet, if you look in the medical journals, the results for Record 4 sit quietly in The Lancet without any hint in the literature about falsification, misconduct, or chaos behind the scenes. This means that physicians around the world are basing life and death medical decisions on a study that the FDA simply knows that it is not credible. Can you believe this? Of course we can believe it. But this guy, Seif better watch his back, because they're not going to like this type of exposure. That is for absolutely sure. Yeah, that was yesterday out of IO9. I'm not in chat right at the second on this computer, but I will. Here's a little bit more. There was another story that came out of Wired. Let me double check and see if there is any other information. Making drugs is tricky. It's also expensive, but it's no shocker that labs take scientific shortcuts when trying to get treatment to market. Where it can start earning back the millions of dollars it spent in development. And remember, we learned from that Tales of the RX drug pusher guest that April and Verstein had on Truth or Talk that pharma companies get out a drug and then they put aside money to handle settlements for injury because it is more profitable that way. It says whenever the FDA catches falsified data or unreported side effects, it issues a warning letter to document the bad research, and that's good. But a new study shows that the FDA also goes to extreme lengths, from bureaucratic obfuscation to outright redactions, to hide any links between the negligence and any particular drug. That makes it impossible to tell if these letters are doing anything to protect consumers. I say the FDA's gotta go. Information ain't always pretty. The busted looking chart, I like that, below is a list of clinical trials, the crucial studies that ensure drugs are safe and effective that contain flawed research. This information came from the FDA, but not directly. Instead, a team of investigative journalists had to scrounge to find the missing links between bad research and the drugs it was performed on. And here's the thing. GMO foods and nanotechnology have already been deemed safe, somewhat safe, maybe safe, but there isn't any proof that we're aware of. I'm trying to open this massive chart and there we go. The proof that it's safe or not safe, we probably will never see. According to this, here, clinical trials and publications affected by official action indicated by rated inspections. And this goes through tons of drugs. I'll post these after the show. And the rest goes into the story then that we read. On the heels of that, did you hear finally? It's happening. They have approved genetically modified apples for sale in the U.S. For anyone who has a kid who enjoys apples, this just means that you got to pay attention more. They don't brown. Oh, everything is like syrup here. They don't brown. And they're going to be feeding them to children all across America. I also was reading that all these new pesticides, apples are actually one of the most pesticide-laden fruits or vegetables that are out there. Oh, look at this. Nothing is going. Hold on. I can sing. With an echo.
We're not going to get to play it.
So hold on. The Food Babe put out a story. So that was my backup, just in case. Let's find her story on GMO apples, and we'll read it. So take that, YouTube. Come on, Food Babe. Load. This is getting frustrating now. I swear to God, it's the data freezing in the pipes. All right, here we go. Would you buy a GMO apple just because it doesn't turn brown? The USDA approves commercial planting of trees of genetically engineered apples to oxidize more slowly. Oh, wait, let me turn this off since we're not playing a video. There's a new-ish apple in the world that doesn't immediately brown after you cut it. Unlike the trademark Arctic, a genetically engineered apple that was approved for commercial planting by the USDA on Friday, this variety is already available in supermarkets, named Opal, the Golden Delicious, that made its debut in the United States in 2010. Oh no, I've seen this one. Offering new hope that the morning's freshly cut apples might still look relatively fresh come a school kid's lunchtime. Yeah, how great. We're targeting toward school children. There are a lot of apples that have the parentage of Golden Delicious that typically do take a long time to brown, said Dan Busey, the orchard manager at Seed Savers Exchange, which grows hundreds of heirloom apple varieties in its Decorah, Iowa farm. There are others, but it's just a matter of time until they begin to brown. A quick perusal of orchard catalogs reveal that some of the other less familiar names, the Gallerina, the Shizuka, the So Sweet, and Cortland, which those are my favorite, the Cortlands, even the Arctic apples, two varieties that were approved for planting by the USDA, a Granny Smith and a Golden Delicious, will eventually turn brown and rot away. So why do we need a genetically altered apple to compete with Opal and these other older apples? Cortland, for one, dates back to 1898, well before the fruit earned its apple a day marketing pitch, back when its strongest association was with booze rather than health. But today, in the midst of childhood obesity and a congressional battle over school lunch politics, of course, all involving Michelle Obama, we want kids to eat healthy. Yes, so let's load them up with GMOs. And having fresh-looking apples in the lunchbox could lead to more nutritious meals. This is very disturbing. So they're targeting specifically school-age children with these apples, and they're spinning it to parents that, oh, look at how great your kids are going to eat apples now because they're not brown, and that is going to make them healthier. But what that's making them are Generation 1, like Kurzweil talked about, experiments. In this new synthetic world that we are going to own here in the not-too-distant future. All right. I'm going to hop to another story that is from February 19th of 2014, so almost a year ago, titled, Wait, There's Nanotechnology in My Food? Well, yes. Think about your last meal. It says, whether it was a big, juicy burger or a kale or spinach sandwich, salad, there was a good chance that something in the meal was grown or preserved with nanotechnology. I'm sorry, guys. I am like so frozen right now. I can't even feel the heat on the heater. For little more than a decade, and I discovered actually in my research that it's been since the early 90s, so it's been way over a decade, more like two or more decades. For little more than a decade, the food industry has been using nanotechnology to change the way we grow and maintain our food. The grocery chain Albertsons, hey, I was there when I was down in the Southwest, has a list of nanotech-touched foods in its home brands, ranging from cookies to cheese blends. Nanotechnology use in food has real advantages. Yeah. The technology gives producers the power to control how food looks, tastes, and even how long it lasts. Wow. We should be so lucky. Looks good and good for you, too, with a big question mark. The most commonly used nanoparticle in food, and we found this out yesterday or Friday from the Australian video we listened to, is titanium dioxide. It is used to make foods such as yogurt and coconut flakes look as white as possible, provide opacity to other food colorings, and prevent ingredients from caking up. Nanotech isn't just about aesthetics, however. The biggest potential use of this method involves improving nutritional values of food. They always sell it that way, improvements of things. Brain implants, they'll improve your memory. Nano additives can enhance or, this is what I was saying, can prevent the absorption of certain nutrients. In an email interview with Popular Mechanics, Jonathan Brown, a research fellow at the University of Minnesota, says that this method could be used to make mayonnaise less fattening by replacing fat molecules with water droplets. Nanotech also helps keep food fresher over a longer period of time. Brown says that the nano packaging industry is actually larger than its nano food counterpart and has three main focuses or foci: barriers, antimicrobial, and sensors. Ideally, now, nano sensors, let's think about that one. Doesn't that sound eerily familiar to smart dust? And what is it sensing? Ideally, the packaging would be would provide protection from moisture, bacteria, and pathogens. There are also a type of packaging that would involve what Brown calls oxygen scavenging, which means that the package would absorb oxygen before it reaches the food. And I wonder if those are the same particles that I posted a story on a few months ago that talks about this new invention that they came up with. And one small little flake of this stuff could suck all the oxygen out of the room. Sounds very similar. And it could hold it and then release it at once they tell it to. Also, Kurzweil, in that clip that we heard when the show kicked off, talking about being able to swim underwater for 4 hours at a time without having to come up and get oxygen, makes you wonder if some sort of oxygen scavenging nanoparticle isn't released and riding on red blood cells to allow you to keep the oxygen in your body without physically breathing. It'd be something good for research if anyone's out there. I know that story's out there. I just couldn't find it while I'm multitasking here. Other techniques have involved coating packaging in nano silver particles to make them antimicrobial, using polypropylene and polyethylene barriers to inhibit moisture. Remember that Sophia Smallstrom was talking about that woman who was doing her own research on some of the objects she was finding coming out of the Morgellon sores on her body, and she identified those strands that were growing as being polyethylene. When I was doing a little digging over the weekend, it seems that polyethylene is a pretty common nanotechnology, polyethylene creation for things. So using polypropylene and polyethylene barriers to inhibit moisture and even embedding packages with silicon-based nanoparticles that can detect pathogens. They are currently being tested, but Brown says that the experiments of food packaging has been successful in the lab. And you know, the one thing, this is already over a year ago, so who knows what's happened since then. The projections for market use of nano food are huge but highly speculative. Some are also really weird. Kraft has shown interest in creating a smart blob that could become any kind of food with any kind of flavor using nanotech. Now, that should be horrifying to you, the smart blob. Basically, you can put this yummy blob into the microwave and specify what you'd like it to be, and the nanoparticles in the food would be activated by the appliance and change color, shape, and possibly even nutrients. Doesn't that sound like a replicator to you? Eventually, the hope is that this food product could become so smart that it would even be able to tell you what ingredient one is allergic to and then block it. If you want to know which companies are using nanotech, check out this user-maintained database. And I think we read this once a couple weeks ago. There are over 1,600 manufacturer-identified nanotech consumer products in the database. Aside from requiring manufacturers to provide proof that nanotechnology foods are safe, the FDA has yet to implement specific testing of its own. Oh, surprise! Many countries are researching ways to balance innovation and regulation in this market. In the 2012 European Food Safety Authority study released an annual risk assessment report outlining how the European Union is addressing the issue of nanotech in food. In Canada, the Food Directorate is taking a case-by-case approach to the safety assessment of food products containing or using nanomaterials. That lack of regulation is a problem for Friends of the Earth, an environmental group advocating a ban on nanofoods until tests have been done to ensure its safety. So let's just let it all out in the friggin' wild. We don't know if it's safe or not. And you know what? We're going to butt slap and slippery palm each other and allow all the safety data that's out there provided by the manufacturers to be published without any redaction, even if it's found to cause adverse side effects. This is bullshit. We do not know the risks, quote, of nanomaterials in food or how humans react to nano additives and where those nano additives may end up in the environment. All right, guys, the end of the show. Make sure you stick around. It is Monday night. We have a brand new Truth on the Tracks tonight. Nick Burnaby and DV live on Anti-Media Radio. Make sure you stick around. Monday is always fun. We are going to retool some of Monday night. I'm going to try and do that today. Mr. Chuck Ocelli is going to have some of his key interviews airing, I believe, starting at 6 p.m. Eastern, 6 to 8 on Monday night. All right, guys, everyone have an awesome Monday. Try to stay warm. We'll catch up with you tomorrow. Take care.